One thing I do regret this year is that I saw Mr. and Mrs. Elrod were there, and they have, I was, I guess, at the beginning of the ball, and I wonder where are those photographers when you want one to have your picture taken, because I wanted to have my picture taken with them. And I saw one of my advisors there, Bob DiMaria, the journalism department. He and his wife were there, and that's pretty neat too. That you drop the label of student, you drop the label of faculty member, and you're just there for the party. You're there for the orchestra and then the big dance. And you see everyone. You look out across the entire ballroom, and you see everyone. You know, their black tie and their dress, and they're just having a great time and no worries. And there's no sense of there's no sense of kids who are maybe doing something they shouldn't be doing. You know, they've had a little bit too much to drink, or they're just having a good time, a good party. There's no looking down upon that. And I don't know if that's not right, but there's you don't feel embarrassed that the professors are there too, because there's not that judgmental aspect of it. There's just people having a good time, and not in the typical environment of the classroom or the lecture hall, but it's just with the orchestra and music. And one thing I want to talk about too is how much I think music is very important here. I don't, maybe I'm just the only one who thinks that, but I associate the good times with music. And I think people here, I love Motown. I think people here love Motown. And there's one group called Doug Clark and the Hot Nuts. I don't know if you've heard of them before. They've been around for 30 years. It's an old soul band, and they were kind of big in the 60s. And at one point, Ike and Tina Turner was their opening act. And they were doing a big stadium tour, and they're not as big as they used to be. They had some records way back when, but they didn't go anywhere. And they now just do fraternity parties, they do weddings and socials, and they do their whole litany of R&B classics, Temptations and the Jacksons and everything else like that. They're good dance music, but their signature thing is they can do their 30 limericks, and they have maybe 30 of them. It's just, you wouldn't want your mother to hear what they're saying at all, but everyone knows the words of these limericks, and it's they sort of fashion it according to the audience, of who's there. And this is this really horrible. They say, what's the difference between a Hollins girl and toilet paper? And the answer is, well, you only use toilet paper once. And the people know the answer, though. He'll hold the mic around in different places, and his whole routine is nuts, hot nuts, get them from the peanut man, nuts, hot nuts, and so forth. And then another verse comes, and what is this or what is that? And some of it's pretty lewd, but that's just kind of a unique thing to them. But getting back to the whole idea of music, I think people like the music that reminds them of a certain time and sort of captures that timeless essence. So whenever I hear a certain song, I associate it with a certain time, and that may be just very unique to me. But you think of like the bands here, like Dave Matthews Band, it has a certain sound almost that sort of captures and reminds you of an afternoon that you spent, where you're at Zollman's or something, and there was a band going on there. It was a beautiful day, and you had your friends were all there, and it's just a lot of fun that just reminds you of things and sort of eases a little bit. And I'm always more comfortable with music, I guess, when that just sort of eases everyone's tension. And I think that people here love concerts and love bands, and they love certain groups that go around, and that kind of sticks with you. I have a huge CD collection now that I didn't used to have, just because I always have my stereo on. And I'm not sure if that's unique to Washington and Lee, but at least I feel that it's important to me, at least just remember certain things like that.
Well, if we're talking about music, we ought to talk about the swing.
Oh, of course, the swing.
Now, I know you have a unique relationship
Yes,
with
I
the
do.
swing,
Yeah.
but is it still sung?
LA football games, they'll play it after a touchdown or something like that. People kind of sing along to it. And it's not, And it's performed at different, every single, I think, concert here, choral concert or orchestra concert, it always closes with the hymn first and then the swing. And that's how every single concert closes. And the last sort of, the last chimes of the hymn go through, then you hear, all of a sudden the piano raises up, and you know it's coming after that, and everyone starts clapping and standing up, and it happens every single time. Everyone knows at what point to clap, at what point to stand up, and at what point to move their hand, and what point to say Sweetbriar or, Wahoos, depending on what your persuasion is. And it's that's kind of, that's where the swing is, it comes into life most practically, I guess, is at every concert it's there, and everyone knows it too. And not, it's just, it's our song. Very special song. It's a good song too.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. All right, you mentioned Zollman's. Take me to Zollman's.
Well, Zollman's, I never would have thought it's the most illogical place to have a party, so far out there. And
out where?
it's
Take
out
me literally.
it's
Take me to
Collierstown.
Zollman's.
It's heading towards Collierstown, I think. I know it's on 11 or off of 11. I don't even know the roads. It's kind of like the houses in town whenever you first get here. You don't know exactly where everything is. You know, at this turn, you turn right, and you don't know. It's sort of the legend, and you never see, you see a confused pack of girls from Holland, so like, does anybody know where Zolman's is? And you know they'd never find it. If you tell them the street names, you're like, well, you go around this corner, and you go about a mile from there, about a mile, take a left, you know. It's everyone has a kind of, it's sort of Oz almost, you have to find it. You head out there, and it's it's a big shack. It's not a barn, but they have a stage there, and it's really kind of run down. It's not at all there for being aesthetically beautiful, and it's surrounded by this big field, and people get their cars, and you usually get a truck with a keg in it, and you kind of congregate around that, and people kind of walk around the cars, and they'll head into the music sometimes. The music also just kind of filters out, I guess, into the fields, and people just kind of spread out, and during the spring especially, it's a beautiful day, you know, it's just nice to be out, and at nighttime, the evenings are very clear, and you see the stars, and you feel very safe out there. You're just sort of off in the middle of nowhere, and it's kind of odd. I don't know why we do it, we just sort of do, and it's fun, though. The only bad thing is getting a ride back. You have to wonder, make sure someone's sober to take you, and you also have a seat in their car, too, because another thing happens, too, though. At the very end, when people are heading out, everyone kind of piles in different cars, you know. Like, so-and-so, do you have a place for me? You know, everyone kind of piles back in and heads back to school, and I don't think anybody's really ever left there, but you just have to kind of wonder, how am I getting home? But everyone seems to get home after a while. And there's a river going by there, too. People can kind of, like, skip rocks in the river or just kind of maybe stick their toe in or something like that. And it's just a comfortable place to have a party. I like it there.
And are they always daytime parties?
No, they're nighttime parties, too. But, for instance, there's the Buffalo Creek Music Festival, which is the weekend after Shipwreck, so put it on your calendar. And that's Friday night, all of Saturday and Saturday night. It's just sort of one continuous thing. They have, I think, 7 or 8 bands out there, just sort of in a row. But for the most part, parties are at nighttime, I'd say. I know Alumni Weekend, there's a party out there during the day, and they had Pete's Barbecue out there, too, and serve dinner, and they have a soul band that'll be going to be playing, and so that'll be fun there, too. But most of the time, it's nighttime. And the best thing about Zolman's is that it's really cheap to rent, and you don't have to clean it up, as opposed to, like, the fraternity house, where you have to make sure it's spotless before the maids get there, because the maids, you think they'd be there to clean, but they're there to find you if it's really dirty. So you have to kind of moderate how much mess you make during the week and make sure you don't make a really huge mess. Otherwise, the university clamps down. They want you to keep those houses nice. And so you have to. But Zolman's, you don't have to worry about it at all because the guy who owns it cleans it up.
And you mentioned there's a party at Zolman's Alumni Weekend. So is that a student and alumni party?
I think it's for alumni, but I think students would be welcome. But I don't think... not a lot of students would head out to hang out with the class of 71 or anything like that. So I think that they would be welcome if they wanted to go, but I don't think many students will head out there for that. But I'm looking forward to that night. They're having the Drifters, the Coasters, and the Marvelettes out at the Pavilion on Saturday evening of Alumni Weekend. So I'm headed out right there. I'm scheming now to try to have my photo taken with all of them. Sometime I'll just show you my room. I have this, I call it my wall of fame. It's just sort of famous people I've encountered or worked with or something, and I have pictures and posters and things like that. And
the world comes to Richard Weaver.
Exactly. I have a picture of myself and Coolio. I mean, you know who Coolio is, right?
Yeah.
Well, he's got a marijuana cigarette in his mouth, which is just really strange. I'm there, and not just my skin, but like everything about me, I'm just incredibly white, you know. And here is like, he's from the ghetto, he says, you know, and he's a gangster rapper, and here I am, and I'm wearing something like this, you know, I'm just smiling, and the two of us together, I just love the picture, because it's just so funny to look at the differences between the two of us. But he was interesting, he was a good concert, too.
Did he really pray for his audience to have soul, to have rhythm, or whatever? That was a great caption.
Oh, I have a good story to tell you, too, about George Clinton. You know, we've heard of Parliament Funkadelic, you know, and the mothership and all that. Well, he was here for Fancy Dress concert last year, the Thursday night concert. And I did a phone interview with him for the paper about 2 or 3 weeks before he was supposed to come here. And it was a pretty good interview. He was talking about music and his inspirations and so forth. And he was very friendly on the phone. So at the end, I said, there's this place in town that, you know, we'd like to go eat. Would you like to have dinner with me before the concert? And he said, sure. And so at the appointed hour, I showed up at the Ramada Inn, you know, outside of town. And knocked on the right door, and you know how the P-Funk All-Stars, you know what they're dressed like. They're very wild-looking people with feathers and beads and multicolored everything. They look very psychedelic, I guess, is what you would call them. And I knocked on the door, and one of the P-Funk All-Stars, the backup singers, opened the door, and I told him who it was, and let me in. And there was George Clinton, you know, what he looks like, at least. He was lying face down on the bed, and all across the room were just handfuls of marbles, like children's marbles, just all over the place. Really strange. I didn't ask what they were there for. And so this guy, he kind of, you know, motioned him to get up, and he kind of got up and looked at me. Remember, we were going to go to dinner, so shook my hand and said hello, and he went to the bathroom, and he put on this red jumpsuit and had Parliament emblazoned right here. And then he has about waist-length braids, you know, with, like, ribbons and things tied in them. And he tied all his braids together, like, in a big braid, and put it on top of his head, and then put a turban around it. Okay, so he was looking very strange, and plus, the P-Funk All-Stars were just multicolored dressed and very, you know, very splashy looking. So we got into my friend's car. I didn't have a car at that point. I told my friend I was going to have George Clinton autograph his seat, but I didn't end up doing that. But anyway, we get in his car. We go to the Lehigh truck stop. So we walk into Lehigh, and everyone turned around. The entire place turned around. I'm dressed, you know, pretty much like this, you know, had a jacket on. And then there was George Clinton there. And then there was, for some reason, there were students there who were having dinner. And they turned around and said, oh, shit, it's George Clinton. And they came over to the table and, like, had him autograph placemats and things, the Virginia map placemat, George Clinton, P-Funk. And so he signed that for a while, and then we ordered our food. And he had a big, big thing of cottage cheese because he was on a diet. And then he started talking about Japan and, like, really, like, I wouldn't tell you this is kind of graphic, but, like, things about women that he liked and Japanese women in particular. It was just kind of odd. And whenever he would be talking, and no matter what the subject was, he'd be talking for some, and then he'd break into rap all of a sudden. And the two singers would join in, the backup singers. He'd be like, and I was telling you this, and then he would start rapping, and you're like, well, and they would join in this whole little song. Then he would stop as soon as he began, and he would finish the sentence. It was the strangest thing I've ever seen before. And he was just telling me stories of, like, fans and crazy people and stuff like that. And then by the time it was time for us to go. And so we got back into the car, and he popped in a tape of some new single he was working on, and they were, like, singing the song that they had on the tape. It was just so weird to, like, have it right there. And I just thought it was very ironic. We're passing by Lee Chapel, rapping about this Jack and His Beanstalk was the name of the song. And we get to the pavilion, and we get back in, you know, that back area there. And he goes into his dressing room. That's where the point where I met a cameraman for Channel 2. I was going to do a TV interview. And 5 minutes later, I knocked on his door and opened the door. And there's just this naked man sitting there. And we're like, oh, hello. So we kind of go around him. And there's a real smell of something in the air, probably pot in the air. And I've never used marijuana, so I don't know. But I'm just guessing that's what it was. And George Clinton sitting back in his chair kind of like this. And he motions. He says, come here, like this. And so we come over, and he said just a bunch of obscenities, answering our questions. I don't think he was trying to be angry, make us angry or anything, but one thing he did say was just really funny. We said, Mr. Clinton, how should we prepare ourselves for your arrival here at Washington and Lee? And he said, well, son, you better be getting yourself some condoms, because when I finish with you, you're going to be feeling sexual. And then we followed him on stage as he began to sing. It was a fantastic concert. I mean, it was just amazing. And it was so loud, too. And I wrote about this in the paper, too, so other people know about it, but it was a really very strange experience, because you had the blackest man in the world here in Lexington, and he was fascinating.
What an interesting So is it the Lehigh truck stop?
The Lehigh truck stop.
Tom Wolf?
Exactly. So I haven't told him this, but I've taken the whitest man in the world to Lehigh, and I've also taken the blackest man in the world, George Clinton.
So just the Lehigh balk when they see you coming?
I don't know. They like me. All the waitresses know me. I don't know. That's my haunt, I guess. I go there and have some coffee at nighttime, so they all know who I am, and, or at least know my face, at least. And I don't know why. There's one cashier. She just really
likes me. It's not the only place you can go late at night around here.
Yeah, that's true. And one cashier just calls me baby. You know, she's like, how you doing? You know, and she's very friendly, you know. And when I came back one summer, they're like, well, we missed you. Where have you been?
And all your little friends. Well, that is a fabulous story. that is truly a classic. I don't think anybody else will tell me that story.
It was funny. Whenever the Alumni Magazine came out with the article about me about the swing, it was on one page, and the directly opposite page was this gigantic picture of George Clinton. And so I have both of them on my wall, you know, just the way it was in the magazine. I just thought it was a bit of a little irony there that's how it came out.
Both of you with your hit singles.
Exactly.
So, I'm interested in the timing of your stay here at Washington mm-hmm. Italy, because you ended with the mock convention.
Mm-hmm.
How important has the mock convention been through all 4 years, or is it really a one-year event? How long?
Well,
I think the lead up.
They started planning my sophomore year, and I honestly had about zero interest in it. I still do. I thought it was kind of a neat spectacle, and I really was not. I mean, I had no interest in it. And I'm not a very typical person to ask about that. A lot of people got excited about it who did work on it, and I just had other things to do. So I guess I'm not a good person to really talk about MockCon, but. When it was here, when I saw it, I was really impressed by it, but as for its preparation, I really just had no interest. I don't know why. I just never...
That's interesting. I would think as a journalism student,
well, it was
you
more,
wouldn't be caught up in it.
Well, I was interested in the journalism sense of actually doing the coverage for it, but that was only when it was actually going on. But with the planning for it was all the drawing up the platform and doing the political maneuvering and research and all that kind of stuff. I didn't want anything to do with that. I just was busy with other things too.
All right, let's talk about the spectacle of it.
It was. I think what really made it was the speakers there, and I think that just by the fact that how they voted on things, and it was just showed that it was. They were pretending to have a convention, and maybe it had was been more valid in previous years, or been more regulated in previous years. And I'm sure they did a lot of work for it. Everyone did a lot of work for it. But when the actual convention came, it was all centered around who could speak when. And I think that that's fine, too. And the speakers were the best part. Newt Gingrich was really a fantastic speaker, I thought. Bill Bennett was a fantastic speaker. And that's what I will remember is the speeches themselves and just the fact they were here, too, in little tiny Lexington. I think that makes it the best. And we had all the trappings of red, white, and blue and the balloons and the signs and everything else, too. But the star of Mock Convention, stars of Mock Convention were the speakers, I think, who were here. That's why I thought it was exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Just to see them here in our town.
So were you a delegate?
No, I was not a delegate. I worked a little bit on the TV coverage of it, and then there's a video coming out, I think this month, which there's a company that was hired to edit it all together, but the students assisted with the taping of the entire thing mm-hmm. in preparation for this video. So that was the extent of my participation, which I would say is very minimal in it.
One of the things that I picked up at my convention that I haven't picked up before or since.
Mm-hmm.
There's some big deal about Texas around here.
Hmm. Oh, yeah, with people booing Texas.
What was the Texas story?
Huh. I just think people just sort of gently ribbed Texas for just about anything. I don't think it was had anything to do with MockCon. And
are there a lot of Texas people?
There are, but there's... I wouldn't say it's too serious animosity if people just kind of gently rib people, just as you might rib somebody from, West Virginia just because they might say they're backwoods or something like that. But it's the same along the same lines of just kind of making fun of people, so I don't think it's too particularly important.
Okay, because that's the only time I've had a sense of it. It sort of kept building to a crescendo,
yeah.
And I wondered, have I missed something here? Okay, let's talk about the speaking tradition.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Mar Cecil, maybe he can tell you, or Rob Mish could tell you, that the speaking tradition has always, was there, and it kind of died maybe in the late 60s, and it was CAFICON primarily who focused their energies on kind of bringing more attention to it. And so the speaking tradition only in the past couple of years has gained priority, I guess, in terms of we have little cards that are printed out saying, speak, it has a picture of Lee and of Washington on it, and inside has the words of the swing, and it's just sort of things we give out to freshmen. So it's almost artificial how it's been brought back. And maybe one of those traditions that is just in a different form now than it used to be. But for a while there, I don't think anybody really tried to enforce it. I mean, I think the students stopped paying the fines in the late 60s if they were fined for not saying hello. They just stopped doing it altogether. And the university or the students just stopped trying to collect the fines, and so it just kind of died out for a while. I think that was part of CAFICON's mission, was to revive that. And so the speaking tradition, a lot of people speak about it as if it's been continuous, from here back until Lee, but that's not true. And I'm not the best person to ask about that, but Rob Mish could tell you that full story there. Whenever he came here, what it was like. But he was a graduate of 76, and then I think he came back here in 84, or maybe even later than that. I'm not even sure when he came back, but he could tell you more about and how the speaking tradition came back again and how people are trying to emphasize it now.
That's certainly my experience because it's new to me, and I think it's wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, I speak anyway. I just get in the habit of just saying hello or just looking people in the eye, you know, and a friendly look is sometimes even better than a hello, you know. Adds to that comfort level that we talked about before, you know. It feels good to be here. It feels good to, like, not have someone glare at you, I guess, when you walk by, or, I don't know. That adds to it, I think.
Okay, getting back to the honor system. How does the honor system coexist with the blatant breaking of laws?
That's another thing we discussed in my show that we did. I should get you a tape of that, and you can see that was all the EC members talking about their impressions of honor and what they're planning for this year, interpretations and so forth. And one thing that Marcus Rayner, he's the secretary of the EC, said is that the honor system does not want to get involved in issues of legality, because you cannot measure, I guess, degrees of legality. Like, would it be an honor violation to break the speed limit? Or would you say no? What about drinking underage or cigarettes underage or something like that? You have to, whenever you get into those degrees of legality, there's a lot of, it's very difficult. So the honor system sticks to other areas that the student body feels, the majority opinion of the student body feels it should. And that's the thing about the honor system, is that it evolves. And it could evolve to involve underage drinking, but I don't think it will. I think it will stick to a general area, the general consensus of the student body. And that's the unique thing about the honor system, is that it's not prescribed by the administration. It's not prescribed by anybody else but the students. They decide what is honorable and what is not honorable. And all the students have to abide by those decisions.
So it really doesn't have anything to do with the law of the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Now, let's say that if I was 18 and I had a case of beer in my hand and the policeman said, "How old are you?" If I said 21, that'd be a lie, and then I could be thrown out of school for that. But just, if I said I was 18, then all he could do was take it from me and cite me, and the honor system would not apply there. It's only when you disguise what you're doing, when you try to lie, that's when it becomes a question of honor. That's where the honor system is involved, and that's why you can't have fake IDs here, because you are lying about your identity whenever you may say, "I'm 21, when you're really 18, or you're really underage. So that's the application when it comes to alcohol, I think, and that's the majority opinion of people right there, I think, of students, that's its most practical application for underage drinking.
That's very clearly said.
Yeah.
But so nobody has any, I mean, obviously nobody has any problems with supplying alcohol to underage people.
Mm-hmm.
That's just plain not an issue here.
Nope.
I think it's an interesting distinction that's made.
Mm-hmm.
But it's obviously the tradition.
Yeah.
What about hazing? Let's talk about hazing.
It's there. I mean, it's not what the administration would want to hear. You know, I don't know how truthful they would want it portrayed, but it's still there. I mean, it's based on the belief that people should work for what they should work for what they get. And you have to work at a friendship. You have to work at building trust with somebody in order to receive the trust of other people. You have to prove yourself, and pledgeship is a time of proving yourself, and so that's where the hazing takes place, is to prove how dedicated freshmen are to certain ideas and to certain things and to each other, to test the unity of a group, to make sure that in times of trouble, in times of stress, will you still be there for your friends, for your fraternity brothers. And if you fail that test, then that indicates on you that it's not for you, that you cannot be completely with the group. And that, I guess, that has sort of a psychological twist to it there. You know, I'm sure it does, but I think hazing, according to the law, is telling someone to do anything, pretty much, and are sort of providing or compelling them to do something. So I think there's a difference between violence and the difference between just kind of petty things, you know, that, like cleaning up or running an errand here or there. I don't think that's particularly harmful, and I don't really disagree with that. But I mean, we don't practice, we don't hit people, we don't attack people like that. That's where the problem is right there, is when you have physical violence. I think that's crossing the line. But part of, if you take a, in, it's hard to say, yeah, I want to be a hazer, or I want hazing here, but that's, hazing is what you can call any compulsion for freshmen to do anything. So you have to look at, the administration is very strange on that. I mean, they'll say no hazing, but what is hazing exactly? And if you try to define hazing, then you get into all kinds of areas of, well, what time of day was it that you asked them to do this, or how far was that place that you asked them to go to? And I think the administration should just butt out of it completely. As long as there's not violence, as long as people aren't being hurt, then stay out of it. I mean, that's part of student autonomy right there. The student should decide what is appropriate, what is not appropriate, in the realm of it not being harmful. And if there was violence, then the president and the administration, I think, would have the prerogative to say, stop it, and we're going to make you stop it. But if it's not, then I think it's not their business. And that's where I think there's a lot of student resentment right now, is the changing of the rush rules to winter rush. People hate that, and people really hate the administration for doing that, too. I've never seen people so angry ever about it. And the administration may trot out someone who's, some student says, well, I agree with winter rush, but that's not the predominant opinion at all. And I sharply disagree with that. I think that's going to lead to a great number of problems. They're trying to, it all involves into what I think students have is the grand conspiracy theory. I'm sure you've heard of it, or you may have heard parts of it, is that the theory is that the university wants to become more like liberal arts colleges and sort of rise in the rankings of U.S. News and World Report, other indications of what makes a good school. And part of that is not having a strong Greek system, having more centralized social activities, having more women and more liberal topics and so forth. And that goes against the character of Washington and Lee. A lot of people feel that the administration is sacrificing the identity of the school in the name of higher rankings on some chart. And some people are angry about that. They feel it's a misplacing of priority. And a lot of people see administration heavy-handedness when it comes to this kind of thing. And I don't believe the conspiracy theory is true, that they're trying to get rid of some fraternities in order to have sorority houses and then maybe have theme housing after that and then kind of break it down completely there. I think that part of the theory is not true because of the incredible investment of money that the school has put into those houses. They're not going to abandon them. But I think fraternities it's important to keep them. And they serve a real purpose. And if fraternities, when the freshmen get here, I mean, including this year, well, not including next year because of winter rush, they have big brothers almost to tell them, this is what you need to do. You need to take this class or not take that class. You need to stop staying up all night, you know, and drinking. You've got to do your work. You've got to focus on what's important here. And I think that fraternities guide freshmen. And I know professors will often, if a freshman's having trouble in class, they'll call up some upperclassman, Sigma Nu, for example, and say, so-and-so, one of your freshmen's not doing well. I want you to tutor him. I want you to make sure he does well. And so and you'll go and you'll help the freshman. And it's sort of like a protection system almost. It's part of like that new family. And this is a funny term, but I call it kind of a fraternal paternalism almost. You have the best you can hope for is fraternities looking out for freshmen. I think they genuinely do. And I think that whenever the administration tries to control fraternities, they hamper their abilities. And not every fraternity lives up to its ideals, but I think for the most part they do, or they try to. And so I think that every single interruption you make in fraternities is detrimental, and it's very harmful. It's makes me very angry, too, that people would interrupt like that.
What's the argument the other direction? What's the argument for winter rush?
Well, this is the funny thing, too, is that the faculty are the people who decide when rush is going to be. And I've never understood why the faculty is empowered with that decision. It's not academic at all, but it's just there. But the faculty feel that the freshmen would focus more on their grades or on their classes if they weren't distracted by fraternities and rush and so forth in the first semester. And also the school says that they want to promote class unity. And this is a concept that I have never, that I feel is impractical. And it's, you can't have 1,600 close people right there. And people are naturally going to little groups. And I think that's just human nature right there. And you can't prevent that. And the question you run into is how are you going to entertain these people for the first semester? I mean, this is a town where there's not much to do. And if the freshman males can't go to parties because of rush rules, you're going to have a bunch of bored people, and you're going to have to entertain them in somehow, and you have to sort of establish alternate social activities for them. And then you're taking away focus from the fraternity system. You're decreasing interest in the fraternity system, so less people join. When less people join, you have less money go back to the school to pay for the houses. So they're hurting themselves, I think, by this process here. And the same thing with the idea of the sophomore housing requirement. They are requiring sophomores to live in university housing this year. And they say it's for two reasons. They say it's because financial, to like recoup some of the money spent on the housing, and it's for class unity. Well, no one believes it's for class unity. It's financial. They want their money back on Gaines Hall and on Woods Creek and the other houses around there. And then I think what I think is really silly is that now they're talking about building sorority houses. I'm in favor of sorority houses. I think the sorority girls should have that because the fraternity guys have that. But what you're going to have again is all these empty rooms in Gaines and Woods Creek because the sorority girls who live there now are going to live in the houses. So you're going to end up with more debt, more buildings, and just a deeper problem because they have upsetted the balance of what used to be here, where people lived in the town after their sophomore year or in fraternity houses. And it was fine that way there, too. And the town depends upon students, and that's a very important part of the economy. And not to say that, you know, that the renting is the only part of student involvement there, but I think that it's important to keep that in mind, at least town-gown relations. You know, that it looks very arrogant of the university to simply withdraw a major part of their market. I mean, people depend upon the university for their livelihood, and I think that that's arrogant of the university to do that. And plus, they're digging themselves in a really big financial hole by doing this, I think. And I've never heard anybody counter that argument at all. I actually did a show about this, too, and I brought up this idea of, you know, this is going to be a big money drain in the very end, and it's going to defeat the purpose which they started out doing. And I feel that the reasons why they're doing a lot of these changes are wrong. They're just for the wrong reasons, and they're going to create bigger problems. But that's just my personal opinion, but I think a lot of students agree with that now, looking back on it. And I have never, ever heard any of the administration counter any of those arguments at all, legitimately. So perhaps that'd be something to bring up to other people, see what they think of that. But that is known as the conspiracy theory, I guess, around campus. That's what I call it. So they see it sort of as the grand master plan. And I don't think it's as devious as that. I just think it's a series of bad mistakes that's going to come back to haunt this place. And I don't want that to happen. I want, you know, this university to be strong. And I'm just afraid they're making mistakes now that are going to have real repercussions later on along the way. That was a real pontification, wasn't it?
Yes. Whoa. Is it comfortable up there on that soapbox? Okay, you made a reference to the big investment the uh-huh. university has made into the houses.
Yes.
How aware are the fraternity members of the concept of fraternity renaissance? What does that mean to you?
Oh, everyone knows that the houses were rebuilt. You know, the university said either you will refurbish these houses up to code, or we're going to call the health inspectors and everybody else in on you, or you can turn the deeds over to us. We'll do it. We'll let you live there if you live by certain standards, you know, certain rules of a house mother and cleaning service and so forth. And it was a very smart move by John Wilson because the fraternities are very important to alumni. I guess that's the alumni. The fraternities have always been important, and to maintain the fraternities maintains interest by the alumni in coming back here to see that things are still well, things are still good when they come back to the houses for the parties and cocktail parties and everything else. And everyone's aware of the huge investment. I think it was $13 million, maybe $12 million for the 16 houses. I'm not sure exactly. But I believe that was financed by either a bond offering or I'm not sure what. But every single fraternity member pays $400 a year in what they call the Greek tax. And the Greek tax goes towards paying that debt of the $12 million or whatever it was that they had to borrow. I think some of it they just outright spent. The rest was financed, and that the Greek tax goes to pay for that. So everyone's aware that they're gently paying, they're paying for this probably for a very long time, and so that's what they see as the leftover fraternity renaissance. And I think it was a good investment. And I don't mind paying it. I think it was right for the university to do.
The fraternity houses are in much better shape
than
they were 20 years ago.
Yeah.
What's the sense of responsibility that members, that brothers have for maintaining them?
Well, if we don't, we're fined, so it's immediately a financial idea, but it's also a sense of pride. Is that I don't want to live in a dirty house. I don't want things broken in my house. It's nice now, and I like it being nice. And so if someone's roughhousing with the furniture, you know, we're real careful about that because it's really expensive, and I don't want broken things in my house. I have real pride in the actual house itself. I think a lot of people do. So it's kind of a maxim. If you give people something nice, they'll keep it nice if you give it to them. You know, in some sense, they have given this to us. And I think that's what fraternity members feel, is they want to keep it nice. Because what can be better than these beautiful homes, you know, wood floors and beautiful furniture and plants and a fireplace, and why would you want to destroy that? So we're real defensive about it.
Okay, back at the beginning, let's go full circle here and finish off. Get me through joining fraternity. Mm. What are the steps?
Well, it differs per year, but in general, I'll tell you, I believe this year you had, when you first got here, that was Saturday evening, that's when freshmen get here, or Saturday they get here, parties start 10 days after, I mean, for 10 nights after that, there's a party every single night by every single fraternity, because the freshmen, you want to get to know freshmen and attract them to come around to your house, and then there's, that's the unofficial part of Rush, and then Rush officially starts at some date after classes have started. At that point, there are certain open contact periods where freshmen can come down to the houses for a cookout. There's no alcohol there, so there's no big parties there for the open contact party parts of it. So they can come down, play volleyball, or watch TV or something like that. And then supposedly they'll come down to your house if they met you during all the parties and if they liked you. So that's when you first introduce yourself. If they like you, then they'll come to your open contact times. And then you have what's called the rush dates, and that's where all the freshmen go to every single fraternity houses and every single in little tiny groups. And it's about maybe half an hour or 45 minutes where you wear a coat and tie. You have, I guess, conversations, but they're in the fraternity house, and it's, you know, a tie on, and where are you from, and so forth. A little bit more formal than the other open contact periods. And by this time, it's hoped that you'll know some of the freshmen and, you know, that you'll like them, and you'll be aiming for certain people. And after the freshmen have gone to all the 16 houses or whatever the number of houses there are, then they narrow it down. They have what are called rush dates, and there are four rush dates, and you pick your top four houses, and you turn that list in, and the fraternities will pick, they'll write a list of the people they want. If lists match, then you have a rush date. So if Sigma Nu chooses Bob, and Bob chooses Sigma Nu, then he has a rush date with us. Now, if we don't choose Bob, he doesn't have a rush date with us. And in most houses, I know it's the case in my house, it's if one person doesn't like a freshman, he's gone. One person can dislike you, you have no chance at all of joining. So that's whenever you know you're invited for a rush date, you know that people really want you right there if you're invited back. And so you come for a rush date. And that's rush date one and two right there, the first two of them. And they said, if they like the freshman, they said, well, actually, they say to all of them, we'd like you to come back for rush date number five. And it is assumed at rush date number five that you receive your bid to join. So at rush date one and two, after they have dinner, a nice dinner at the house, you take them upstairs and you talk to them a little bit at the house and say, we'd like you to come back for rush date number five. And they say yes or no, and you write their name down and so forth. And then after one, two, three, and four, rush dates one, two, three, and four are done, then everyone has a meeting to talk about the freshmen. And it's at that point that if someone doesn't like you, they can get rid of you right there. And we all vote to extend a bid after we talk about the attributes or the negative qualities of all the different freshmen we're considering. So at number five, and then if we've invited someone to number five who just got killed in the process, we call them and say, never mind, sorry, you know, you can use the time for something else. If they don't hear from us, they come back for five, and then after dinner, there's another nice dinner at five, they are offered a bid there. And then supposedly they can be offered bids at rush dates 5, 6, 7, and 8, but most of the time it works where they're offered bids at 5 and 6. And then they're invited back to dinner for 7 and 8 just to come back to dinner again. That is on a Thursday, I think. That's a Wednesday, Thursday. And then they come down and tear their bids on a Friday night at a party. And then we see those photos right there, you know, people, the big mass of people. That's the tradition, at least in my house, where at the first band break, everyone goes out into the well, and all the women have their beers and pour beer and water and things all over all the guys, and you rip off the shirts of the freshmen and you give them a new fraternity shirt. And that means they have torn their bid there. And that's how they join. And that's the beginning right there. That's all within the first 2 or 3 weeks of when freshmen get here.
So a freshman can receive bids from numerous houses.
Yes, and then he chooses which one he wants.
And is it typical to get bids from several houses?
I'd say two or three. Not beyond that, though.
Two. And is that because the freshman has concentrated on those two or three houses?
Most of them. I mean, you have to have made an impression in order to be invited, in order to be given a bid. You have to know who you are and have socialize with you and like your personality and the discussions they've had with you. And we don't penalize, we don't say, well, he's been over that so-and-so house, so we're just going to forget him anyway. I mean, there's genuine competition between the houses for people. And then
so
freshman to science.
Hundreds of people.
Mm-hmm.
How can you really get to know hundreds of people?
Well, you just try, I guess. You figure it's about 250 men that there are. You just try.
Yeah. And you're obviously a big proponent of the system. Oh, it seems to work.
Absolutely. And I see no problem with it at all.
And how many people fall through the cracks? How many people don't get invited who want to?
I'd say 10 to 15 maybe don't join the fraternity system. Either they weren't invited or they didn't rush. And there are some people who are independents here who seem to be happy with it, and that's fine. I mean, more power to them. But most of the people are very unhappy about not being in fraternities, or they get very bitter about the power of fraternities and the predominance in the social scene, and then they leave because they can't, they don't want to be in that environment anymore. And that's what gets back to what we initially talked about, is that there are very few people who are not like other people because they tend to leave if they're not accepted into the form, into like the traditions. And that's the problem with Winter Rush, is that if you have a couple months period where people don't join fraternities, then you have probably fewer people who will join them, more people who don't, and they may be more disaffected and they may want to be entertained in different ways and feel they're owed entertainment, you know, and owed something to do. So then you get an idea of maybe having a theme house for them or having activities for them. But the problem with that people feel is that everyone pays a student activity fee, and then people pay their fraternity dues on top of that. And my fraternity, I pay fraternity dues for things I do with a fraternity, and that's, you know, that's what you get for your dues. And you get certain activities with your student activities fee, but I feel that my student activity fee should not be used for the entertainment of other people, you know, in their own little groups. They should be willing to put the extra money out, like I do for my fraternity dues. They should be willing to put out the money for their entertainment. I shouldn't be paying for another person. And that's why people resent independence sometimes, because some of them feel as if they are owed something because they didn't get into the fraternity system or they didn't want to. So there's resentment on that level, too.
Well, there's certainly a lot of things to do on this campus that don't really have to do with... I mean, from my perspective, I look at the calendar, and there's a lot of interesting things to do here. Mm-hmm. Maybe not social things,
yeah,
but interesting things when you get to be an old fart like me.
Yeah, but for the young folks, though, everyone wants to have friends.
But what I want to say is that a lot of the things that I attend, I'm amazed at how few students are there.
Hmm.
And a lot of the things that happen at Lenfest Center,
yeah,
it doesn't seem to attract students. Is that because they're involved in things at the fraternities, are offered not of interest to students?
I think that some things that are offered are just not of interest to students, and I think that has nothing to do with fraternities at all. It just, I don't know, I'm not always interested in walking to Lenfest on a Tuesday night if I have homework to do, too. It just really depends, and that's why some things are attended more than others. It's really not dependent upon anything like that, I don't feel.
Well, the house fills up even without you, but
yeah.
But it's interesting to me to look around,
yeah,
and know that this is a university and how few students I see there.
Yeah.
All right, now let's move. I have very little tape left, but
okay.
Am I right in my perception? Did 4 women just get elected to the presidents of each class? I saw the list of people who were elected to class officers.
It could be. I don't know.
That isn't anything that anybody pays any attention to. I thought it was kind of remarkable. It looked to me, I guess you're as a senior, you don't care
it,
that
it would
much.
Be if it was maybe the second year of coeducation, it would be remarkable. But I don't feel that women, I don't feel it's unique for women to be in leadership positions here anymore because they've been around long enough and they've worked hard enough. And I don't think people make that distinction, oh, a woman president as opposed to a man president at all. I just don't feel that's there anymore. And I mean, that's a good thing. Perhaps, you know, we've sort of gone beyond the blinders of you know, better dead than co-ed, I guess.
Well, anything you want to get in here that we haven't yacked about?
I don't think so. But we can do this again sometime. If I think of something new, I'll tell you, I guess.
You have any more exciting trips to Lehigh?
Oh, yeah.
You want to get on tape? That was a great story. I'll have fun playing that with people. But, you know, something I've never heard you mention is sports. Are athletics of importance?
Athletics are very important. Not to me personally. I don't like sports. I mean, I never really have. I mean, people who play them, I respect them, but I couldn't care less about sports, honestly. So.
But when the football game happens, is there a big crowd out there?
No. And I would say that even for people who like sports, the reason why they show up is for the tailgate parties, which are in the parking lot, except for that. People go to lacrosse games at ThinkPoint, I think that's because the lacrosse team wins a lot. The football team doesn't win a lot, and people will only go, there's a whole joke that the only time you ever see a football game is if you were talking to somebody at a cocktail party who had their back turned to the field. You might look over their shoulder and see there's a game going on there, but you wouldn't really focus on it. And people go to homecoming and go to maybe parents' weekend, but that's it. I've never sat through an entire football game, never had any interest in doing it, and that's just not because I'm not a sports fan, it's just because no one does it. I feel sorry for the team because there's no one out there, but it's just the way we are.
It looks that way to me. I don't hear people talking about it.
Yeah. I'd agree.
All right, well, my little light is flashing, so I guess we've used up an hour and a half.
Out of tape.
It's been fun.
Oh, that'd be fun for me, too.